Hi, everyone. My name is Larry. I'm an alcoholic. And believe it or not, this is water. It looks like gin, but it's not.
Want to smell?
As I said, I'm an alcoholic. And last week I came to this meeting. I've been around. There was been something I was involved in across the way a few months ago, and I saw where the meeting was. I'd heard Bill, promoted at different meetings that I've seen him at, but the long and short of it is I really didn't know where it was, and all of a sudden I saw him here one Wednesday night, and I said, "Is this where the meeting is?" And he goes, "Yeah." I said, "Well, go be me." I came to this meeting last week to kind of get an idea. I hate to walk in. Forgive me if I kind of ramble a little bit. It's been a long time since I've been asked to speak, and I really appreciate your patience and your forgiveness if you'll bear with me a little bit. But the fact of the matter is that I'd never like to walk into a meeting where I've been asked to speak blind. I've done it a few times, and the results were disastrous for me more than anything. Because I didn't know what the format was. I didn't know anyway, a lot of confusion. So I like to see where I'm going to be if I have that opportunity. And so I came here last week to see what the format was and how it's laid out and, where the people sit and where the coffee is and all that stuff. And lo and behold, to my pleasant surprise, I was able to listen to the lady that spoke here last week. Her name was Danette. And if you were here last week, you know what I'm talking about. And if you weren't, you missed a good pitch. I will tell you that. You missed a good pitch because she touched on some things that I'll probably touch on myself tonight. But the fact of the matter is she brought home a lot of memories for me as an alcoholic. Extremely good pitch. I was so impressed with her, and I can only hope that I'm a quarter of as good as she was last week, because she really impressed me, and I was very moved. But to kind of get on with it, with that said, and I should tell you that my great-grandfather was an alcoholic. My great-grandmother was an alcoholic. I still have her muff gun. If nobody knows what a muff gun is, it's a little Derringer. It held seven shots, and it was a .22 long rifles, and women in the Midwest would wrap their hands in a little fur, what they used to call a muff. And she kept it there just in case the revenuers showed up at the door, because she cooked her sour mash on the farm there. My grandfathers were alcoholics. My great uncle was an alcoholic, although he was a periodic alcoholic. His father, my father, my mother, and I'm a drunk too. And there's no nobility in that. I wish I could say that, with some sort of conviction or some sort of ability that gives me some sort of badge of honor, but the truth of the matter is it's being an ordinary, common, run-of-the-mill, stuck out of a brown paper bag drunk is not a noble thing. And I am that person. I could probably sit here and spend a good portion of the evening telling my drunk log. I will tell you that I was introduced into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was about 1972-ish. I'd hit a house. They were moving a house, and I hit it in my car, and I was drunk. I like to get that out of the way. I'm reminded of it every day I look in the mirror, because the scar on my face that I used to be able to hide with hair, the older I get, the more hair I lose, the bigger it gets. So, as a consequence, I see it every day, the evidence of my misspent youth. I was given a court card. My license was jerked, of course. I fortunately didn't hurt anyone except myself. And I was introduced into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, had my court card signed off, and got the hell out of there as quick as I could. And I understand. I totally understand. If you're on a court card, by all means, I totally know what you're thinking. Okay? If you're here and that's what you want to do. I have no problem with that. I hope you, you know, if you do have a problem, you decide to come back, because now you do know where you can come. I was fortunate because I knew where I could come. And it was about three and a half years later that I finally drug my ass back into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous with a tail between my legs saying, I can't do this anymore. And I'm not going to go into all the sordid little details, but suffice it to say that I tried to kill my girlfriend because she was stepping out behind my back, and long, sad story, big deal, you know, jealousy, envy, all that crap gets in the way, plus, you know, a quart of booze, and, you know, I can go through any door with my shoulder, and I did, and took it out, frame and all, and, you know, obfuscated, it's a mess, okay? And I'll get into that in a little bit later, because that story is kind of important in the sense of the ramifications of it. What I really came to talk to you tonight, and I don't see a lot of people, I mean, they do, but a lot of it has to do with their past history and how they drank and so on. Let me just tell you, when I got into that car accident, my blood alcohol count was 0.36. Okay? I drank a lot. I drank every day. I was 21 years old. That's how I drank. And the fact of the matter is that at that time, legal limit was 0.1, not the 0.08 that we have today. Yeah, lightweights. Truth of the matter is that, you know, 0.36, let's face facts, at 21 years old, I got a problem. But I didn't know I had. See, that was normal to me. I lived my life like that. So when I did come into Alcoholics Anonymous, 3 years later, I was drinking as bad, if not worse, than I had that evening. I was a daily drinker. I had a job. I kept a job, sometimes just by the skin of my teeth, but I had a job, and I kept a bottle at work, and I was able to do this, and I would go up and get a cup of coffee, and I'd lace my coffee with booze, and I drank pretty much all day long. And then at night I would go to a bar and I would drink until the bar closed. I ran out of money, or I just said, okay, I can go to sleep now. And that was one of the things. I could never sleep. I don't know about anybody else, but I had to drink to pass out, because that's the only way I could shut off the brain. And like I was saying last week when I was listening to Jeanette, she talked about filling that hole. Now, if you be alcoholic, then you're going to know exactly what hole she's talking about. It's that hole in our guts where the cold wind blows, where there's nothing there. And that hole has to be filled, pardon me, that hole has to be filled pretty much on a daily basis. There was also a lump in my throat that I could never shake, and this brain would never shut off. I had to drink. I had to drink to kill it, to click it off, to shut it down, to sleep. Well, sleep was actually passing out. And probably most of you that are here and are admittedly alcoholic know exactly what I'm talking about when I say it's not sleep, you're passing out. You know what I'm talking about. Yes, I had blackouts. Yes, I did all of those things that people do. I've woken up many times on a freeway trying to figure out where the hell am I and looking for a landmark. And when I found it, being relieved as hell. And then the next day, checking the front of the car, making sure there was no bones or skulls or other things, you know, attached. So that's how I drank. And when I came into this program, dragging my butt, I said, I can't do this anymore. And the person met a few years before took me to their house, and they plugged in a cassette tape of a speaker meeting. Don't ask me who the speaker was. Don't ask me what he said. I have no clue, because my brain was on. It was clicked on. I hadn't had a drink. I hadn't had a drink all day. I was sweating bullets. I was sitting there thinking about this and thinking about that. My brain felt like a pinball machine. Now, I don't know if any of you know what that feels like, but I do. And the fact of the matter is, it would not shut down. And I'm going, Jesus Christ, what am I in for? I don't know what I'm in for. Anyway, we talked about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have no idea what they said. I don't remember. I wish I did. All I know is that I wanted to stop drinking. That's all I wanted to do. I could stop for a moment, for a day, for a week, maybe. But it always drew me back. And that was pretty much just willpower, doing it that way, white-knuckling it, just stopping. And that was very difficult, and that's why I always ended up back drinking again. The fact remains is that when I went home that night, I had to work the next day, and I had to get up early. But I'm sitting there, and the mind is just, I don't know if any of you have ever experienced it. If you have, you know what I'm talking about. But it's just going 1,000 miles a minute, and things are jumping in and out of your brain, and it will not shut down. And the images and the pictures and the ramifications and the guilts and the remorses and the this, it's all happening all at the same time. And you get one thought in your head, and you're off to another one. It's happening that quick. It's, you know, it's the speed of light. Now, I came in, and I did not believe in God. Okay? Didn't believe in God. Came in as an atheist. But that night, I said, you know what? As skeptical as I am, I'll give it a shot. And it was a way to disprove, you know, to disprove them and prove me right, of course. And that was my thinking. And finally, in the middle of that evening, where I'm looking up at the blank, dark ceiling, and I can't fall asleep, I just looked up and said, God, please help me. And the next thing I remember is waking up with enough time to get ready and go to work. That moment brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, I listened to the speaker. I don't remember who it was, what he said. It could have been Bill Wilson for all I know. But the fact remains is that it brought me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I looked up and I said, I can get ready for work. I can get there. And I fell asleep. What an amazing thing, because I couldn't do it on my own. And I said, maybe there's something to this. Maybe I better investigate this a little bit more. So that night I went to a meeting after work. And I started going to meetings on a regular basis. And I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. What I did not know is through the moments when I asked for help and I went to the meeting and I, you know, at the person's house and I went home and I asked God for help, I'd already done steps 1, 2, and 3. I didn't realize it, but I'd already done it. I was there. That was April 9th, 1976. I'm happy to say that I have not had a drink since that period of time. But what I did have was a moment of clarity, and I had the ability to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for a long time, for a couple of years, I had 3 steps. Okay? 1, 2, and 3. I lived with those 3 steps for a couple of years. Some people do the 4th step right away. I have nothing against that. I don't condemn or condone anything that's done in the program as long as the person stays sober. It all works. It's all good. Some people have their way, other people have theirs. You know, I firmly subscribe to live and let live. I've always believed in that. And the fact remains is that what works for one person doesn't necessarily work for another. We'll get into that in a few minutes. But the fact remains is for a long time I 3-stepped. 1, 2, and 3. 1, 2, and 3. And in about two years, a little over, somewhere in there, started getting, you know, this crap that I've either blocked out or forgotten about or probably both was coming back to kind of haunt me. And so a person gave me this 12 and 12. This book was the beginning of really looking at the steps and going to a 12 and 12 step size. I went to those meetings, and they're very important. They were very important to me. I don't know if they will help anybody else, but they certainly helped me. And I got to tell you that that allowed me to do the next step, which was the four steps. A lot of people do it, and they do it well, and they do it the first time, and they do it within a few months, and that's fine. That's great. If it works, great. I knew a guy that didn't take his four step for 14 years. He stayed sober. He hurt like hell, but he stayed sober. And that's the fact. And when he finally did his fourth and fifth step, he no longer hurt because he had the ability to go on to six, seven, and eight. And with that ability, the pain eased. Well, I'm not one for enduring pain emotionally because, frankly, that was a foreign feeling to me. I knew about anger. I can tell you all about anger. I knew about despair and loneliness. I can tell you all about those feelings. But I cannot tell you about the other things. About love, about giving, about sharing. I didn't know those things when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason I didn't know those things is because I was self-obsessed. I was self-centered. I was selfish. I was a son of a bitch. And that is why I had to come to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know it at the time, but I learned about these things. And it was through the step studies that I went to. And the fact remains is that I was, you know, everybody talks about it. Well, not everybody, but a lot of people have talked about it in the past, before you guys, after you guys, and probably long into the future about that four step. You know, that four steps are really, you know, it's a hard step. I got to write all this stuff down. I was no different. Okay, the fact remains is that I had to go into myself and find out what made Larry tick. And why he did these things, and what he was doing, and why he was doing them. And the best example I can tell you that I used for my four-step model was in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I believe this was the fourth edition, right? Okay, I'm a procrastinator too. I still have the third edition, okay? The first 164 pages are the same. They say the exact same thing, word for word, in virtually the same spots. It's the stories afterward that have changed a little bit. Some better, some omitted, different things. It's all good. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I will not short that book one iota. It teaches me something every time I read it. I can look, and I'm sure other people are similar with this. I can look at a paragraph one day and read it and say, you know, it looks to me like this means this. And 2 weeks later, I'll look at the exact same words, the exact same paragraph, and I'll go, oh, well, maybe it means that. And I get a totally different interpretation out of the same exact words. And it's the same way with the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the same words, but I see something different, or I see something I need to use in my sobriety. So, with that said, I used the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous model for the fourth step, and that's what I used. Now, I trusted somebody, and I went to them, and I said, look, I've done this fourth step. You know, now I realize I'm supposed to share this with another human being. You know what? And I'm really having a hard time with that one. You know, I've dug down deep to get to my innermost feelings and resentments and fears and crap. And now I got to share it with somebody? What, are you kidding me? Are you nuts? I don't want these people to know what I'm like. And he said, well, there's other ways to approach this. And he said, you know, you can use a priest, you can use this. Well, I'm not a church guy, for obvious reasons. But the fact remains, he said, well, no, no, no. So I had to look around for a long time to find that person that I could trust enough to share this crap. And when I did, I will tell you, when I went home that night, I did feel a sense of relief. I felt a tremendous feeling kind of lift off my shoulders, because there had been some pain brewing there. And, you know, those old-timers, they used to say, pain is a touchstone of growth, you know, all that happy crap, and you just want to smack them. You know I did. And they shut up, you know. But that's how it was in those days. And the fact remains is that I felt that relief when I did that fifth step. Did I trust the person? Yeah, I did. And I'm glad I trusted that person at that time. I'm very fortunate in that regard. When that happened, I was transferred to a place, beautiful downtown Indio, California. And if you've ever been there, you know it's a hole. And if you've never been there, be glad. The first day I was there, it was 127 degrees. I knew I arrived in hell. If you don't know where Indio is, it's about 25 miles south, roughly southeast of Palm Springs. The Coachella Valley, wonderful Coachella Valley. Anyway, it was hotter than blue blazes when I arrived there, and I had to work in it, and that's a long story, but the fact remains is when I got there, I had already done step 6, 7, and 8. And I was trying to live this program. And when I arrived there, I didn't know anybody in the Coachella Valley. And I called central office in the Coachella Valley, and I said, where's the meetings? And they gave me a list of meetings. And I went to a meeting. And I popped my ass down in a chair, and I listened to different people. And I got to tell you, my work schedule was such that, you know, I'm trying to explain to you that sobriety is not necessarily easy, but rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And sometimes when you thoroughly follow a path, it's not an easy thing, especially with life, the dealings of life. And one of mine was my work schedule. One day I was working 7 to 4. The following day I'd be working 12 to 9. The following day after that I was working 10 to 7. What I'm trying to get at is that I had to fit meetings in and around these work schedules. Plus, I had family obligations, okay? Family obligations. I got married early on in sobriety. I, again, neither condemn it nor condone it. Nobody told me about relationships. I swear to God, nobody talked to me about relationships. Not that I would have listened anyway, it probably wouldn't have. But the fact remains is that I got married early on in sobriety. I was about 5 months sober when I got married. And she had a son, and we started this family. Well, I moved to Indio, and by this time I was about 2.5, 3 years sober. And the fact remains is that prior to that, I was working in the South Bay in Long Beach. And I should tell you that there was a young lady there working with me that was kind of showing me that she was very available. And, I'm like, cool, but, you know, I'm married and all this is, anyway. I don't want to get into all the details of it, but the long and short of it is that about nine months later, she and I ended up in an affair. She was married, I was married, and we were having an affair. Now, I tell you these things because I'm trying to explain to you, I have made so many mistakes in sobriety, yet I've stayed sober. Okay? Why is this? Well, let me go back. When I did my fourth step, in my fifth step, the affair had long been over. But the fact remains is that I was carrying this guilt around I mean, it was just heavy on me. So when I talked to my friend, he said, look, you're going to pray about this, and you're going to make a decision on how you're going to handle it. And one of the things that he told me and talked to me about was, it's in the books, but it talks about relieving our guilt at the expense of another person. He says, we don't want to do this. Okay? You don't want to intentionally hurt somebody just to relieve your guilt. So sometimes we just got to eat it. And I got to tell you, I prayed about it and I ate it. I did not tell my wife about this. Is that deception? Yeah. Is it with good intention? Yes. Okay? Never asked if she cheated on me. I didn't want to know, frankly. But the fact remains is that I was able to do it that way. And one of the things that I did was that I prayed to God to try and be a better husband, to try and be a better man, to try and be a better father to her child. And I got to tell you, when you're down, you know, when you're down like that, when you're in those kind of things, you know, it's very difficult to sit there and say, you know what, I'm wrong. I don't know anybody that likes to admit when they're wrong. I'm no different than anybody in that regard. I don't like to admit it. You know, it talks about it in the 10th step, promptly admit when we were wrong. I don't promptly do anything. You know, not when it comes to that stuff. You know, a lot of times I'll try and rationalize and justify it, but the fact remains is that, you know, this is one of the ways that I had to handle that kind of thing. And that was the only amends that I could make to her. And it talks about that in the book. If you've stolen from your company, you work for a company and you've stolen, but you don't want to lose your job because it's your livelihood and it's paying your rent, it's paying the grocery bills and so on and so forth. The books talk about doing something that will help you make amends without revealing that you're the guy that took the money. And he said, maybe you can take a part of your paycheck and you send it anonymously to your employer, and in that way, once you pay off the debt, you're able to, you know, make that amends in that way. And it talks about stuff like that. It says there's no right answer specifically. Everybody's got to look at it from their perspective with the people that they're dealing with. And maybe at that point, you know, the decision will come. Because God does let us intuitively know that which we wouldn't ordinarily know if we reach out and ask Him. It's happened to me many, many times. It's one of the little tiny miracles that happen. Now, I don't know about anybody else, but I can sit here and tell you about problems that I've been faced with, whether it's at work, whether it's at home, or so on and so forth. And I've looked at the problem and stared at it and tried to figure it out every 6 ways from Sunday. And I say, you know what, I've had enough of this. And I get up and I go and I get a cup of coffee. And I come back and I'm sipping the coffee and I look down at the problem and all of a sudden there's the answer. It's right in front of me. Has that happened to anybody else here? It's happened to me many, many times, and it's like, now why couldn't I see that just a few seconds ago? It's right there. It's plain as the nose in my face. And the fact remains is that I look at it as a minor, little, tiny miracle, if you will, given to me by God. For a guy who didn't believe in God, I sure have developed a belief in Him these days. When I got to Indio, California, I'd worked my steps right up through number 80s. And I found a guy that I asked to be my sponsor there. And his advice every day was, read page 86 and 87 of the Big Book. Only he had one of these gravelly, gruff kind of voices, you know, page 86 and 87 of the Big Book. And that's how he talked. And every day I'd call him and we'd talk about what was going on and every day. And every day I got the same answer. Read page 86 and 87 of the Big Book. And this is what I did. I got so goddamn tired of hearing him say, read page 86 and 87 of the Big Book. I wanted to fling the book at him. What he was trying to show me is that that was step 10 and 11. Step 10 and 11. Step 10 and 11, because that's where I was at. Now, a long time ago, after I tried to go around and make amends, such as I will, and I'll come back to that in a moment, I had heard somebody say, you know what, the 12 steps, somebody broke them down for me this way. And I thought it was so simplistic, but it was so kind of logical. So the first three steps would get right with God. Second three steps would get right with ourselves. The third three steps would get right with the people that we had harmed. And the last three steps are maintenance steps to keep that conscious contact with God as we understood it. And I looked at that and I thought, that's kind of marvelous. That's just kind of a neat little thing to kind of hang on to. I said, yeah, first three steps, get right with God, get right with me, get right with the people I had harmed. Okay, that makes sense. I like that. So I kind of hung on to that in the back of my brain. And when I was working 10 and 11, I would take the message wherever I could to other meetings the best I could. Not to say that I did always well, but I tried to carry the message the best that I could. A lot of times, the only way I could do it was by example, whether it was a bad example or a good one. Now, I've already told you one thing that happened. I told you a little bit about why I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't go into all those details. The fact remains is that the night that I had tried to kill the girlfriend and so on and so forth, I had the opportunity a few years later to try and make amends with her. I wanted to make amends with her. She was the last one I really had to sit down with and say, you know what, I screwed up big time. I owe you big time apologies and whatever I can do and so on and so forth. Well, for God knows what reason, she didn't want to see me. I knew why she didn't want to see me. It was obvious. So I let it go. It was another year or so later that I had the opportunity to do it again. I thought, well, maybe some more time has come by. I will try and make amends with her one last time because she's still the last one on my list. So I made the attempt. And for obvious reasons, she didn't want to see me. So I made this attempt at making amends the best I could. Now, some people talk about writing it out and then maybe burning it or writing it out, sending it anonymously. Well, I didn't want to do that because she was married. I didn't want to open that can of worms. I'd already been down that road. Thank you very much. Didn't want anybody chasing after me after that. So the fact remains is that I said, you know what? There's only one amends I can make to that woman. That's to stay sober. I will do my best to stay sober. I will do my best to maintain a lifetime of sobriety. I know I can maintain a lifetime of sobriety. The only way I can do it, though, is one day at a time. See, each day is given to me, and I have that choice to whether I want to go out and drink or I don't want to go out to drink. After my first divorce, and that should have been pretty apparent, getting married that young in sobriety, I moved back to Los Angeles, and I was going through kind of a rough time at that time, for obvious reasons. Going through a divorce can be very painful, whether you're drunk or sober. For me, it was sober, and it was still somewhat painful. But then as time went on, and as I worked through whatever emotional issues that I had, and there were other things kind of too long to get into, but the fact remains is that somebody had asked me to be their sponsor, and he was a couple of years less sober than I was. He was about 10 years older than me, and I said, sure, why not? Yeah, why not? And the next thing I know is that he and I are roommates. We're splitting rent, and now we got meetings we're going to, and we're palling around with each other, and we got somebody we can bounce things off of, and we got hot and cold running women, and a nice apartment, and, you know, wonderful furniture, and that kind of stuff, okay? And I was living the life of Riley, and so was he, and then I met this gal that was in the program, and she was getting sober, and she had about a year in, and that's when she and I got married. A few years later, she had to go back out, and that was also a very painful time, okay, to be straight up about it. Probably more painful than the first one. But the fact remains is that I went through that in sobriety. I've been married 3 times in sobriety. You might say it's a hobby. The truth of the matter is that, you know, marriage is hard work, and it can be, and everybody's got to participate in it, and not everybody does. Okay, it's a difficult thing. But a lot of people come into this program, new people come into the program, and they're already married, or they're already involved in some sort of relationship. And the only thing I can say is that if you are, do not drink no matter what. I don't care if the guy goes out and blows 10,000 people away with a bomb, you don't drink over it. Or the girl, or whoever. You don't drink over it. You don't have to. That's what the program is for. That's what the steps are for. That's what that book's about. That's what you call your sponsor about. And you can raise hell with your sponsor. You tell him what a rotten SOB he is, or she is, or whoever. But the fact remains is that you do not have to drink over that. You do not have to drink over finances and romances. You know, a lot of people are going to, can't help you. Okay? If you choose to come here, then we can help you. If you choose to call your sponsor, they can help you. If you choose to read the book, that can help you. If you maintain a conscious contact with a power greater than yourself, who today I call God, he can help you. Or it can help you. What I'm trying to say is there's nothing in this program that cannot be done if you are willing to pay the price for it. And what price are you willing to pay? You want to go on an emotional roller coaster ride? Yeah, hook up with that person. Okay? By all means, do so. Don't drink when it goes south. I'm telling you true. Why do I say this with conviction? Because I've been through it. I'm telling you, you don't drink, no matter what. There were some days all I could do is just sit on my hands and wait for the pain to pass. Because I had to live the pain now. I couldn't drown it out. Couldn't kill it. You just live it. Life gives people tragedies, whether you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous or normal people. Life gives people tragedies. It's part of life. It's how we deal with it. What's the next step? What do I do now? I pray. I meditate. I work with that power greater than myself that I choose to call God and try and maintain a conscious contact. I attempt to carry the message that Alcoholics Anonymous has freely given me. The program through the 12 steps has given me the ability to live life on life's terms. I like quotes. I don't know if anybody else likes quotes. I like quotes. I like people who can encapsulate a sentence or a few words and say what I believe or what I think. And one of the quotes that I remember is from Abraham Lincoln, and he said that most of us can go through the trials and tribulations of life. And I'm kind of paraphrasing him right now, but most of us can do that. But if you want to test a person's character, give him power. Give him power. Do they use it? Do they abuse it? I have probably worked probably over 40 years of my life, and all but 7 of those years I've been a manager of some sort. Some power. It's not the President of the United States by any stretch of the imagination, but it is the thing of being an employer to employees, being a manager. I can tell you straight up that I've made every mistake a manager can make. I look at that today and I go, geez, what an asshole I was. You know, I made that mistake. I treated them like crap. I did this, I did that. I try not to do that today. I really try hard not to do that today. The reason I am able to look at that critically in myself is because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps, the conscious contact with a power greater than myself that I choose to call God. Because when I got here, I did not have a God. I found God here. Now, you can believe that, don't believe it. I know it works. There's other people here, better than I am, that will tell you that it works. And you can continue your life, living it the way you want, in one disaster after another, because I'm sure that's the way it's going to be, unless you choose to believe. If you choose to believe, I guarantee you this, your life will get different. And it's going to get better, and it's going to get bad. But one of the good things that I enjoy about this program is it has that little saying, this too shall pass. So when things are really bad, really, really bad, know this, that this too shall pass. And when things are really, really good and really going your way, know this too shall pass. It's a double-edged sword. I like even. I like serenity. I try and get there every opportunity that I can. I hope I've been able to share with you a little bit about my experience in sobriety. Again, it's very difficult to explain, and it's hard to encapsulate 33 years of living with this program and sometimes not well and making every mistake I can make. And it's very difficult for me to give that and show that to you. But I will tell you, this program saved my life. I would have it no other way than what I have right now. And I'm not going through some great times at the moment, but I can tell you this, I'd rather be doing them this way, sober, than drunk. Because drunk, problems are still there. And on top of that, I probably have a liquor bill and a hangover. So, you know, the choices are yours. The choices to be made are yours. All I ask is that you try this program and give it an opportunity to work in your life. But the only way it will is if you work it. I thank you for allowing me to share with you tonight. I thank you for you paying a 12-step call on me, because this is part of the program that I have a difficult time with in trying to carry the message the best I can. So I want to thank all of you for allowing me to share.